This is Dr. Michael Ward interviewing Dr. Alison Pittard, the Dean of the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine, on the 29th of October 2020. And can I first thank you for spending the time? I know how busy you must be at the moment, but for spending the time to talk to me about this this COVID
You're very welcome.
Situation we find ourselves in. So I what do I know about you? I know you describe yourself as an anaesthetist and an intensivist, but where did you do your training right at the beginning? Let's very quickly go over your...
In Leeds. I started in Leeds. So I was brought up on the Wirral.
Right.
And applied, obviously, to uni. And Leeds was my last choice in university. And for a variety of reasons, Leeds didn't interview at the time, and I got an offer from Leeds and didn't get any other offers. So it was by default that I came to Leeds. So I did house jobs in Leeds and Bradford, and actually started anaesthesia in Bradford purely because I had a mortgage and a car loan. It was 2 weeks before the end of my house job, and I'd wanted to do medicine, so I'd applied for medical rotations, and they weren't successful. And Bradford needed an anaesthetist, and I needed a job. So I thought, I'll do it for 12 months. It'll be good in terms of resuscitation and IV access, and ended up loving it.
Right.
So I stayed there, and that was my first venture into intensive care, because obviously, as an anaesthetist, you do some intensive care. And although I was quite scared about being with the critically ill, there was something about it that attracted me, and then moved to Leeds as for my second SHO job, and then progressed through the various stages of training.
Well, you can't go much higher than you've got in
intensive. No, I know, and who would have thought?
When did you become Dean of the Faculty of Intensive Care Medicine?
12 months ago tomorrow, so 30th of October last year.
Just in time for the pandemic.
Well, it's ironic because I found out I'd been successful on the 11th of July last year. And I remember that because that's my husband's birthday, and we were on holiday in Greece. And once I'd sort of, you know, come down to earth, I said, oh, I hope I don't have to do any media stuff because I hate it. And my husband said to me, oh, you'll be fine. You just need a flu pandemic and then you'll have...
Okay. I know. Has he given you any other tips?
Oh, dear.
And you must have done the two threads. So you did anaesthesia, or did you go straight from anaesthesia straight into intensive care? Or did...
Well, of course, at that time, you couldn't train in intensive care on its own. So the only extra intensive care training you could get was by doing what used to be called the jacket jobs, the Joint Advisory Committee and intensive care jobs. And at the time when I would have done those, there were 12 posts in the country. And I applied to do one in Leeds, and I was up against a colleague of mine, and he got the training post rather than me. So I've had lots of failures in my career, but they're the sort of things that, you know, an opportunity arises and I go for it, because I think if you don't go for something, you'll regret because you don't know what the outcome would be. So I didn't have any extra intensive care training on top of my anaesthesia. But during my training, if ever anyone, there were gaps on ICU or training blocks, you know, I'd offer myself and go and do them. So I always wanted to do an intensive care job as a consultant.
And in the job that you're doing now, I mean, maybe now is not a good time because you're doing presumably a lot of time to do with the faculty, maybe not going to London as much, but spending a lot of time doing what we're doing and talking. But in your normal life, before, outside of the pandemic, it's all intensive care. No,
I still do anaesthesia. So I do a day a week doing colorectal anaesthesia, which is fantastic, actually. It's a Friday, which a lot of people think, you know, why do you want to be doing something like that on a Friday? But as when the children were younger, my husband's also an anaesthetist, he just did a Friday morning list. So it meant that he was always free in the afternoon to get home for the kids. So I didn't have to worry if the list overran because I didn't have any domestic commitments. So it suited me. And also because it's a lot of cancer and, you know, high risk surgery, I still kept my hand in with practical procedures, which on ICU, the trainees all want to do them all. So it was I felt it was a fantastic balance. And anaesthesia, my Friday in theatre is my chill out day, which people think is odd when you're doing major colorectal stuff. But it's nice. It's, you know, confined to four walls. I can't be in two places at once. And I've worked with the same surgeon for almost 20 years. So it's great.
That's one of the beauties of the old style training and the old style way of doing things. I don't know how long it's going to carry on like that, but we'll see.
I know.
And when did you first become aware of coronavirus and realise the impact it was going to have on us all? Can you cast your mind back to when that might have been?
Well, I'm sure it's certainly at the beginning of the year. So towards the end of January, I'd gone to the doctor's update meeting in Val d'Isère, which is the first time I've ever done that meeting. And there were a number of colleagues talking about it, people concerned about it, and asking me in my position as dean. Before that, I'm sure I was aware of what was going on in China, and certainly because we'd heard about that over Christmas, I think, at the end of last year. And so when I got home from France, end of January, beginning of February, and I think it was sometime in February that we had the first case in the UK. But even then, as things were slowly increasing, I don't think it really hit me until probably the end of February, when I was getting phone calls from people who were involved with NHS England, you know, about ventilators and things. And it made me realise that people higher up were looking at it more from a strategic point, because at that point, I think I was still in my bubble doing my normal daily work and doing the London stuff. But I think when I realised that people in that position were concerned and were starting to put in contingency plans, I thought, this is real. This is actually going to, you know, to hit us.
Well, you were aware then earlier than most people.
Yeah.
I was in LA. My oldest son lives in Los Angeles, and we were over there visiting him. And we flew back from LA because California had already registered the fact that it had a lot of cases. And we made the decision to self-isolate because we'd been in California. We'd come home. We didn't want to meet any of our friends. And certainly I've got another son and granddaughter here.
Mm.
So we self-isolated and suddenly found it all happening around us. You know, we took the decision, and I think in retrospect, we were probably right to do so. But we've been virtually self-isolating since then. So that's the end of February, the very beginning of March. I think it was March the 2nd or 3rd we got back.
Yeah.
And we thought we'd be in for 2 weeks.
Yes, I know.
It's crept up. It's overwhelmed us now.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know, you were aware, when did you start to notice it as far as patients were concerned? When did the numbers in your ITU start to become a concern to you at the same time?
No, it was later. I mean, I suppose I have to confess to not having worked clinically during the first wave, because I broke my foot, I think it was about the 19th of March.
Okay.
And we then went into lockdown the following week. So apart from, you know, the beginning of March, I didn't work clinically. But certainly at that time, over the first 2 weeks of March, the number of cases in critical care was starting to rise. And there was concern about having enough staff to deliver the service. So just as I had to stop work, then that's when people were starting to push for a national statement to stop all but emergency and urgent surgery to free up capacity and staff.
You'd broken your foot, but you were still able to go into the office and go up to do your other duties for the faculty?
Well, I did it all from home because, of course, we went into lockdown about 5 days afterwards.
Right.
And so I couldn't have, I mean, I had planned, I'd bought myself, because I was on crutches and I was non-weight bearing for the first 2 weeks, but I'd got myself a rucksack to use as a handbag because right. I thought, well, I can get the train to London, I can get a taxi to the station, and so I would have been able to do it, but ironically, we weren't allowed to. And so I did everything from home and didn't stop. And I suppose, had I been working clinically, I would have had to balance both. I mean, it was bad enough just doing all the faculty and media stuff, but it meant in some ways I could focus on that. It was very interesting because initially I was very angry that I'd broken my foot at the one time when I was really needed in terms of, you know, my specialty. And then became frustrated and felt really guilty for not being at work and being there with my colleagues and supporting them. But ultimately, I realised, or people made me realise, that the faculty and the national work was just as important because somebody had to be involved to lead how the specialty was going to respond. And also for public messaging as well, because it was so confusing for people. And I just hoped that I could give a clear message that would mean people wouldn't panic, but they'd actually listen to what everyone needed to do to keep themselves and everyone else safe. So it was a very different way of working and focus than I had envisaged. But I actually think it was needed, and I am glad that I was able to do it.
And you feel, in looking back on it, that was the best use of your skills at the time?
Yes, because I couldn't work clinically because of my foot. Yeah. And I could have tried to do some administrative work for the trust, but actually a lot of the administrative work stopped. because everyone was focusing on clinical stuff. So there was really nothing that I could do for the trust.
Did things go well for the ITUs?
I think they did an amazing job, as did everyone across the country, because usually, you know, when you work in anaesthesia and intensive care, you're often used to the unknown and the unpredictable, but never on this scale, you know, with a brand new disease. And I think the way everybody focused, adapted as we learned new things, worked together, and the non-intensivists, doctors, nurses, allied health professions who came and helped, it took a toll on them physically and mentally. But the way everyone worked together was just an amazing feat, and I think that is, you know, something to celebrate.
If it happened again, or maybe I ought to say it is happening again,
yes, yeah,
what are we going to do different this time to make it even better?
I think it's looking after staff is the most important thing, because we don't have enough staff to start with. So I think a lot of the non-intensive care staff found it really stressful and being taken out of their familiar environment. And so I think certainly in my own organisation, they have spoken to all those staff to get their views of how they worked during the first wave and how they think, if they wanted to help out second time around, how they think that could be done better. In a supportive way. So I think listening to how those people were affected and how it could be better, I think you maintain some resilience in the system, both for during this next wave and also beyond when we get back to normal working. So I think that'll be a big change.
Okay. there were two ways in which non-intensivists were being used. One was because they were being drafted, because anaesthetists at least couldn't give routine anaesthesia because that was all stopped. So that was a useful fact because it moved people sideways, all of whom presumably had some degree of experience during their training, if not since. But there were techniques that were being introduced that weren't widely being introduced. Could you say a few words about the sort of things that were being done that were different from what we used to do, if you like?
Yeah, so, I mean, the way that we treated patients themselves changed over time. We all thought at the beginning that this was going to be a bad flu, bit of ARDS, you know, we can deal with that, it's not a problem. We knew from what we saw from other countries in the world that patients were pretty sick, and the advice that we were getting initially was don't delay the inevitable, intubate early, because otherwise you have a very unstable patient. So that's why initially I think we had large numbers coming into intensive care and we were overwhelmed because everyone was being intubated. And also at the same time, we were being advised not to use high flow oxygen or CPAP because of the risk of aerosol generation and transmission of COVID in hospitals. Now, there were some organisations around the country that thought, well, if we can put infection prevention precautions in place to protect staff and other patients, we will try and use non-invasive ventilation, because if that can take some of the pressure off critical care, that's good. And then we got more advice from Italy that said, actually, we're having to use CPAP because we've run out of critical care capacity and some of those patients are doing really well. So maybe we should be using CPAP. So the national advice started to change to say, some people will be really sick when you first see them, so they're probably going to need intubating straight away. But consider non-invasive ventilation, because for some people, that will be all that they need. They won't deteriorate to the extent of needing invasive ventilation. And again, in some organisations, patients who were just on non-invasive ventilation were cohorted on wards outside of critical care, managed by other professions, maybe anaesthetists, respiratory physicians, acute physicians, supported by intensivists. So that freed up critical care capacity as well. So that was one change that occurred during the first wave, which obviously will carry on and be utilised in the current wave. And we also found that the disease was more than just a respiratory disease, because one of the things we didn't appreciate was when patients came to critical care and were intubated and ventilated, we had difficulty oxygenating them. And that didn't make sense until we found out the effect on the coagulation system and the development of microthrombi. So again, we then started to look at anticoagulation. And although we don't fully anticoagulate patients, we tend to give them a higher dose of anticoagulant. So whereas before they might have only received their low molecular weight heparin once a day, the advice now is to give it twice a day, but not to therapeutically anticoagulate them, because there's still the risks of that. And that hasn't been elucidated, so it wouldn't be appropriate to do that. And the other big thing is the dexamethasone that was shown to have an impact on survival. We've gone through the phase of remdesivir and people using remdesivir, and now the evidence suggests that it doesn't actually have any impact on outcome. So we started off not using that, started to use it towards the end of the first wave and in between, and now we certainly wouldn't start it in intensive care. If a patient arrived on intensive care already on it, we probably finish a course and then stop it, but certainly everybody in hospital would get dexamethasone. So it's very, very different to the first wave.
Yeah, Carl, I told you I'd spoken to Carl.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
One of the things that he mentioned also was the turning. and how critically important that became. I mean, I've heard of it before. As I say, I'm not an intensivist, but it became almost synonymous with management, and everybody was turned on a regular
basis. That's right, because we in intensive care have used proning for patients who we've had difficulty oxygenating for a while. And when, as I said before, the patients were coming to intensive care and we struggled to oxygenate them, everyone was being proned. So whereas pre-COVID, we might have the odd patient on the unit proned, we were finding that all patients were proned. And that puts a huge burden on the staff because you've got to turn them. But then that got extrapolated to use in non-intubated patients. And so the advice was patients who were on wards, who were receiving supplemental oxygen or non-invasive ventilation, for them to prone themselves because that would have a benefit. And it certainly seemed to benefit patients. But at the time, there were only a few very small sort of observational studies that suggested a benefit. And actually, I've just read an article this morning from an open source journal, I think it's called Critical Care, looking at proning patients who are on non-invasive ventilation and comparing those with patients that don't get proned. And this was from a number of sites around, I don't know if it was just in America or whether it was worldwide, but they looked at about 200 patients in total, and there was no difference in intubation rate between those that were probed and those that weren't. But you know, for every paper that says it doesn't work, there's going to be other papers to say that it does work. And I think it's really difficult when you're in the height of a pandemic to make any sense of things. But proning, certainly in the awake patient, doesn't do any harm. Proning patients who are unconscious on intensive care, you can get pressure sores and things like that. But by the time you're on intensive care and you're sick, we do know the evidence is that proning is of benefit.
I'm not interviewing anybody that's not an anaesthetist, but I understand from conversations I've had with one or two friends who are surgeons, is they felt useful all of a sudden in intensive care. They normally made remarks like, you know, I don't like going into intensive care because I always feel I'm in the way. But suddenly they felt as if they were part of the team and they were being useful. So we found a use for a surgeon.
Absolutely. I mean, I can remember being on an Academy of Medical Royal Colleges call, and we were talking about needing as many people as possible to help. And the faculty led some of the very rapid cross-skilling and upskilling. And I can remember talking to the president of the Royal College of Surgeons of England at the time to say, we'd really like your help to promote this. And he said, what? You want surgeons to help out? So yeah, you'd be real. And he was flattered, surprised, but yes, and we collaborated with the Royal College of Surgeons and got a fantastic training package together. We called it hashtag Better Together and tweeted it everywhere, and it was really good. Although there were some of the surgeons that I work with, who didn't get involved in critical care. They sort of felt a bit out of it, and all they wanted to do was operate. They were just chomping at the bit and, you know, wanted to know when they could get back to do some proper work.
Shame. I mean, here we are watching the numbers going inexorably higher. Are we going to be okay?
I think we are. And that is based on what I know through my national work, what I can see locally, and talking to the experts like Chris Whitty and Steve Powers, and you know, they have all the figures and the modelling and access to, you know, all of that data. And right at the beginning of the pandemic, I saw the modelling figures based on various different interventions in terms of if we didn't have a national lockdown, if we did, if we had a partial lockdown. And the graphs that I was shown showed that with a lockdown, a national lockdown in the first wave, we see the massive peak and then it tails off. But then as you go on and lockdown is eased, you then get a second wave, which isn't as high, but goes on for longer. So my interpretation is what we're seeing now is exactly what the modellers, the Department of Health, you know, statisticians, etc., what they modelled based on, you know, what their experience was. And certainly that is still the story. But everyone feels that the peak isn't going to be as high, that it will go on for longer. And what we have to remember is the numbers seem quite worrying at the moment. And people saying, you know, they've got more patients in hospital than they did in the first wave, that the number of positive cases is significantly higher. But part of that is because we're testing more people. So we didn't know everybody who was positive in the first wave. So I think this time the numbers will be higher in terms of positive cases, that we will get more patients coming into hospital because it's being recognised earlier, but that the patients coming to critical care won't be as high, but we'll have to manage it for a longer period of time. And of course, it's really crucial that we continue to maintain some normal activity as well, so that patients who don't have COVID still get the care that they need.
Is there sufficient manpower to do what you just suggested? It seems as if it's going to absorb a huge number of intensivists, anaesthetists, nurses, physios. Will there be enough people to do it, or will we have to draft yet more people in?
There's not enough manpower to deliver critical care in the way that we normally do.
Right.
So, you know, in a line with our national standards. And so what we have to do is look at how we can deliver it safely with the staff that we have got. And in the first wave, there were lots of plans drawn up talking about, you know, so we have the one-to-one nurse patient ratios for critically ill patients. There were guidelines drawn up that went as far as going to 1-to-6, you know, if things really got bad. That isn't sustainable. And even where staff were trying to do at a 1-to-4 level, it was not sustainable. So the idea is we deliver critical care differently. So rather than one nurse delivering everything to one patient, that the guidance now would be for a short period of time, in order to manage everybody in critical care, we could move to a 1-to-2 nurse patient ratio. So that would be one critical care nurse responsible for two critically ill patients, but there would still be another registered nurse at the end of each bed. So there are some generic skills that any nurse can deliver, and there are some skills that only a critical care nurse can deliver. And of course, some of the registered non-critical care registered nurses have gained some skills during the first wave. So care would be delivered as part of a team. It makes it more stressful for the intensive care nurse because they're trying to spread themselves, but it's the safest way to do it. Otherwise, you'd either turn patients away, or patients are being critical care but actually not getting critical care because you'd be running around trying to do everything. So that's the way that you can do it, and also moving out of critical care where there's surge capacity and trying to deliver that. And in terms of medical staff, obviously anaesthetists have some critical care training as part of their anaesthesia. And so the closer certainly the consultants are to having finished their training, and certainly the trainees will feel much more comfortable helping out in critical care than those that are further on in their anaesthetic consultant post. So I think it's looking at the skills that people have and working out how you harness that to deliver care on a team-based approach rather than as individuals. And I think by working together, you can support each other as well.
Yeah. This plan, as you described it just now, has that been produced, written, distributed?
It's so the guidance that had the 1-to-6 was was published much earlier in the year. And so it's all being refined, and the 1-to-2 ratio has been devised by NHS England and will be published very, very shortly. And that has, to me, that is a very sensible approach. But what has been said, the caveat is obviously there's a pressure still on hospitals to deliver their planned care. And there has been some pressure put on critical care departments to move into their surge staffing levels, i.e. move to 1-to-2 to support non-COVID work, which isn't sustainable, because if you have staff starting to move into that pattern, then they might not be able to sustain that through the next wave. So moving to a 1-to-2, or what we call like a surge workforce pattern, is only appropriate for a short or relatively short period of time to support COVID activity, not for planned care.
What about the Nightingale hospitals? Do they fit into this plan?
Yeah, that's really difficult, because, I mean, it's an amazing thing that they did. You know, when you watch the time-lapse films of how they were put together in a short period of time, so amazing. And I think at the time, the idea was that we'd put critically ill patients in there. And that was a bit scary, because, of course, you need some trained staff to do that. But you're taking staff out of the NHS hospitals, diluting the expertise further. And that was a worry. And in fact, they weren't used to anywhere near the extent that was expected, and many didn't receive any patients.
I've already interviewed Alan McLennan, who was the medical director of the London in Greenwich. And I think there were 20-something patients at the peak when they had a facility that was going to take several hundred.
So I think even in the first wave, the Nightingales were going to utilise a different model depending on their geographical demand. So the Northwest were going to use theirs differently. So they were never going to put the critically ill patients. They were going to put recovering patients in the Nightingale. I think this time round, I think people have realised that we should be able to keep the critically ill COVID patients within the NHS footprint. Because certainly when you look at the actual numbers from the first wave, we never had more than the total number of critical care beds in the country. I think we started off with around, was it 3,500, 4,000 beds? And we never had more than those critically ill. So I think we need to look at another use for COVID patients. Now, in an ideal world, that would be patients who are recovering from COVID, or, you know, recovering or needing rehab for other conditions, which would then free up ward capacity. But the problem with the Nightingales, they weren't created for awake patients, they were created for sick patients. So certainly the Nightingale in Harrogate, which is my local Nightingale hospital, has no windows. You know, you could imagine people going delirious if they're there with no outside to look at. I mean, you can mitigate against that, I know, but it's not easy just to say, we'll use those for all the recovering patients. But obviously they're still there, ready to do what's needed. And whether you could put operating theatres in them and have a completely cold site, I don't know how practical that would be, but I think they're a resource that could be used to take the pressure off the NHS.
Another thing that came up from more than one person I've spoken to about this was the effect it had on staff of the patients not being able, the critically ill patients, dying critical ill patients, who couldn't see their relatives, and how the effect it had. Will that change in the second wave, do you think? Will we be able to provide for the contact that families need to not feel this terrible tearing apart of their fabric?
All around the country, different organisations manage that differently. So I think they'll still be that variation. I think last time that there were a number of concerns, one of which was the amount of PPE that was available. And obviously it was really important to keep that for frontline healthcare workers and social care. This time round, we've got loads of PPE. The procurement team at NHS England have done a fantastic job. We've got months and months of stockpile. They keep replenishing that. So we're not going to run out of PPE. So that's not an issue this time. But there is an issue about transmission. And if a relative comes in and, you know, sees their loved one. And so there needs to be a risk assessment. But I think seeing the impact that they're not being able to be there when the patient was dying, the impact on the family and the impact on the nurses will need to be taken into account. And even during the first wave, there were some exceptions where relatives, usually just one relative, but, you know, somebody was allowed in. And so I think having learnt from that, then there will be a more liberal policy, because even the staff found, even if a patient wasn't dying, they didn't realise how much communication, informal communication, goes on at the bedside when the relatives come to visit. Mm-hmm. And so that they get regular updates and have that conversation. And so it makes any formal discussions much easier because the relatives are already quite well informed. So it made it very difficult for those communication teams who are contacting relatives at home on a daily basis.
I'm delighted to hear what you say about that, because it certainly, I mean, I wasn't there, but it clearly had an effect. And the other thing was the doctors who became ill. We had several doctors. And a couple of the ones that I've interviewed out of the seven already, two of those did catch COVID. They both of them mercifully recovered very rapidly. This is an anxiety. So the next thing round the corner, I hope, is the vaccine. I don't know if you have any lines. I mean, I'm in Oxford, but nobody tells me anything. But do you have any information about how far away we are from the vaccine? Do you know?
Well, the two that look most hopeful are the Oxford vaccine and the American one. I can't remember what that one's called. And the Oxford one, I think, are talking about early next year, whereas the American one says they might be available maybe as early as mid-November. So there will be a vaccine, and I think the work that's been done to get those through, what COVID has done is liberating all sorts of things, not getting rid of lots of red tape. The vaccine studies have all continued to be safe, because obviously you need to make sure that there are some things that don't change. But I think losing a lot of red tape means that we've been able to expedite certainly the vaccine research. So there will be a vaccine. And I know that NHS England, the Department of Health and everybody, it has drawn up deployment plans, so that I think from as early as maybe next week or the week after, they have a plan where if a vaccine became available tomorrow, then they institute this plan so that they can vaccinate as many people as possible, because it would look awful if the vaccine became available and it was non-deliverable because of lack of planning. So the plans are all there. So as soon as the vaccine is available, it will be administered to whoever, you know, because there won't be enough vaccine to do everybody at once. So it'll be done in a phased approach, but it will be available. Actually, I've got a teleconference with the chief medical officer this evening, where one of the questions we're going to ask is about how far are we off with a vaccine. But I think it's really, really encouraging. And that's the one thing I think that will break the transmission and start to allow us some freedom and get back to normal, because the way we've lived this year is just dreadful. It's, you know, it's everyone's had a different experience, but to me, it's not living, it's existing.
But I wanted to ask you about the personal effect this has all had on you. Your life must have been turned upside down by all this business. You said your husband was also an anaesthetist.
Yeah.
And I think you've got...
got two daughters, yeah. 20 and 21, they're both at uni.
I mean, their lives must have been dramatically altered. What about the effect it's had on you personally? You strike me as the sort of person that just carried on. That doesn't appear to have had a direct effect on you, but do you see it in your colleagues at all?
The effect on my colleagues is very variable. I've seen a huge impact on my theatre nursing staff who went and helped in intensive care, who have been mentally traumatised by that. And I can remember when I first went back to work clinically, going into theatre, and one of the staff, it was like they needed to offload. And because I'm an intensivist, they knew that I would understand. And one of them spoke about a patient that they were involved with who was a 40-year-old gentleman who was there with COVID. He'd been talking to him because he was looking after the patient. And that patient ended up deteriorating, being ventilated and dying. And of course, in theatre, patients aren't dying all the time. And his wife, who's also a nurse, had similar experiences. And that really hit home to me, that the gravity of the impact that it had on them. Obviously, critical care staff are more used to people dying. We have a higher mortality rate. But I think on them, it was the number of patients, sick patients, how sick they were, the having to work in PPE and how uncomfortable it was and changing their working patterns. But I think everyone was supported together. And I think because it was a single wave, that everyone knew there was going to be an end to it, that got them through. And I worry now for this next wave, because it's almost like, oh no, here we go again. How are we going to manage this again and maintain it all over winter? Because there's talk about this carrying on until sort of the spring. Mm. And, you know, having that to look forward to is awful. So I think the impact, the physical and the psychological impact on my colleagues, you know, all professions, is going to be more significant this time round than the first time round. So I think that's why I say staff, we really need to look after the staff more so this time than last time.
I'm absolutely certain that what you're saying is correct, but it goes even wider. What do you think about the effect on the general public? Are they becoming resistant to the advice? I see people in the streets around Oxford who are clearly not distancing, who are not wearing masks, who are behaving what I think is irresponsibly. And I suspect that I'm seeing a very small cross-section of the population. I don't know what you've seen.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are fed up of it. A lot of people are confused, because obviously we've got the various tiers and lockdowns. And obviously that's in an attempt to protect the economy. So you can see the reasons for that. Although no one wants another national lockdown, if everyone's playing by the same rules, it's easier to understand. I think the public understand the rules in terms of hands, face, face. But I don't think the public really understand that it's not just about protecting themselves. So you might have somebody who says, well, I'm young and fit, I'm not going to get it, or if I do get it, I'm going to have a mild disease. So what does it matter? I won't wear a mask, I won't socially distance. And I think if there was a way of either a cartoon or something, and I mean, there's been lots of pictures, you know, things to try and show it. But if one person got infected, had a mild disease, but they saw how that then passed on to other people, then that might make them realise. And also, if they pass it on to an older member of their family, or a member of their family wasn't able to get their cancer surgery because the hospital was full of COVID patients. So I think it's, unless you can see something that has a direct impact on you or your loved ones, it's easier to say it doesn't affect me, doesn't, you know. And I mean, that's a very sort of general assertion, but I do think that is one of the reasons. And that's not criticizing people. I think that's human nature. You know, it's the way people behave. And if you have people like me on the news dictating, I mean, that doesn't go down very well. So you just have to try and explain what the facts are and hope that people listen.
I think you're right. I think it's a depressing time because it's the weather doesn't help.
Yeah.
It was easier 3 months ago when we were expecting good weather. We could get out more reliably, walk, keep fit, exercise, fresh air. Much more difficult now. It's a depressing period we're living in.
And
I thank you for taking the time and talking to me. Look, I must generally ask you, is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked you? What I'm after is your experiences and your thoughts about where we've been, where we're going. Is there anything else I've missed out on that I should have asked?
No, I mean, I suppose the only thing is I'm an eternal optimist. You know, sometimes too much. And I think when we get through this, we'll be in a much better place. So I think the NHS will be better. And I think the country will be better, forgetting Brexit, because who knows what effect Brexit's going to have. But we won't go down that route. But I think the positives that have come out of this will, you know, reap benefits for years to come. And yes, it will be different. You know, city centres, lots of them, ghost towns, because people have learnt to do more online shopping and things. So we're going to have to adapt the way that we live from our experience. But I think if we make sure that we're open to those changes, just, you know, from your own personal perspective, then I think things will be good. And certainly, although things in the NHS are bad at the moment because of the demand, I think the moves, the positive moves and the things that we have created during COVID put the NHS in a much better place. We've moved forward 10, 15 years in terms of what we can do and things that have been developed. And I think realising that you don't need all the tiers of management, all the tiers of red tape to get things done safely and effectively. And they're the sorts of things that we need to harness to make sure that we don't forget.
Well, I hope the powers that be, for want of a better expression, are listening.
So do I, yeah.
They're more likely to listen to you than they are to me. But thank you so much. I'll call this to a close. I really appreciate you taking an hour. I know how busy you must be. Good luck tonight with your
interview. Thank you, yeah.
And stay well, and I hope you and your family continue to go well. Thank you.